Welcome to Lessons in Tanya, Chapter 30. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on really quite an introspective journey. We're unpacking Chapter 30 of the Tanya.
A really profound text.
Absolutely. Rooted in Hasidic philosophy, delves deep into ethics, psychology, spiritual transformation. Our mission, as always, is really to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, those key insights from these sources you shared. We want to offer you, our listener, a shortcut to being well-informed on its teachings.
And it's quite something.
This chapter, it builds directly on what we talked about last time, right? That state of insensitivity where your heart just feels dull, unresponsive to, divine greatness.
Exactly. Chapter 29, it explored various methods, pretty powerful ones, for crushing one's spirit, tackling that arrogance of the, what the text calls the animal soul's negative inclination.
That ego-driven part of us?
Right. Self-centered desires, earthly impulses, all that. But chapter 30 introduces another approach. And honestly, it's perhaps surprising, maybe even counterintuitive at first glance.
Okay, intriguing.
We're going to delve into a teaching that doesn't just challenge our usual ideas about self-perception and humility. Mm. It really aims to redefine them. It shows how even the most, diligent, the most observant among us can gain profound insight.
Yeah.
By looking at those we might typically consider, less observant, maybe even misguided. It's a journey into what true humility actually means and what it takes to genuinely transform from the inside out. Not just changing actions, but changing being.
Okay, let's unpack this central instruction then. It sounds intense. The text says, "One who suffers from this insensitivity of the heart must also set his heart to fulfill the instruction of our sages. Be lowly of spirit before every man."
Mm-hmm.
Now, like you said, first glance, it might sound straightforward. Be polite, be modest, just basic good manners, maybe some self-effacement in how we interact.
Like simple social etiquette.
Yeah. But as we dive in, it quickly becomes clear this holds a much, much deeper meaning. It's far more challenging than just acting humble. It demands a real internal shift, a sincere conviction inside.
Indeed. And understanding this is key. The ancient wisdom this comes from actually distinguishes between two very different kinds of humility. Getting this distinction is absolutely crucial.
Okay, what are they?
So the first type is what we might normally call modesty. Or maybe an absence of self-glorification. This is where, you might acknowledge your own good qualities, your achievements, your spiritual level.
You know you have them.
Right. You know you have them, but you genuinely see them as gifts. Gifts from the divine. You understand deep down that if someone else had been given those same gifts, same talents, same opportunities, they might have used them even better, more effectively.
So it's a healthy perspective. Acknowledging blessings without ego.
Exactly. A balanced view of your strengths. But then there's the other type.
That's where the real challenge comes in, isn't it? The almost impossible demand. Because it's not just about being modest about gifts.
Precisely. The other type of humility, and this is the one specifically pointed to by the exact phrasing of this ancient teaching, is a genuine, profound, internal feeling of inferiority, of lowliness compared to others.
Feeling less than.
Yes. Hmm. Not just acting like it, but sincerely feeling it. Believing yourself in some fundamental way to be inferior. The instruction uses very specific language pointing right at this deeper, much more demanding kind of humility. It requires an internal state of being truly lowly, genuinely diminished in your own eyes.
Wow. That's a huge ask, especially for someone who is trying hard, who is diligent, observant, striving for spiritual growth. How can someone like that genuinely feel lower than someone who, seems to be going in the opposite direction?
And that leads directly to the core difficulty, the paradox.
Yeah, here's where it gets really interesting. If we're talking about a sincere internal feeling, a genuine belief you are inferior, why would you be expected to feel this way towards every single person, even the individual the text calls the lowliest sinner?
Someone who seems completely immersed in actions contrary to divine will.
Right. Someone who seems totally removed from observance, ethics, higher purpose. It just goes completely against conventional wisdom, doesn't it? I mean, most people, if they're striving, would naturally feel maybe a little superior, morally or spiritually, to someone they see as an utter evildoer.
This teaching asks us to flip that whole perspective on its head. It demands a radical dismantling of the ego.
So how did people grapple with this historically? It seems like a major stumbling block.
Oh, absolutely. This very question, understandably, stumped many ancient commentators, many spiritual thinkers. Faced with this difficulty, how can the observant person genuinely feel lower than the non-observant? Some scholars tried to, well, soften it, make it more palatable.
Yeah.
They suggested it meant something like conduct yourself self-effacingly toward every man, basically suggesting an outward deference, an act of politeness, of respect, treating others as if they were superior without necessarily having to believe it inside.
So focusing on behavior, not belief.
Exactly. For them, it was about decorum, social harmony, avoiding arrogance, while still letting you keep your internal sense of your own spiritual standing, sort of managing appearances.
Like a spiritual workaround. But the author here, the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad Hasidic movement, a huge figure in Jewish man, thought he wasn't having that, was he?
Not at all. He objects quite strongly to that interpretation. He emphasizes the specific wording, be thus. It implies it must be a sincere internal state, not just an act, not just a show. You have to genuinely feel this way deep down.
It's not playing a part.
No, it's about arriving at a fundamental truth about yourself and your place. And crucially, he stresses this sincere lowliness must apply in the presence of every man, even in the presence of the most religiously irreverent people.
He uses a strong phrase there, doesn't he? Referring to those seen as the most worthless or neglectful.
He does. Those who seem to have completely abandoned any path of observance or connection. So if we accept the Alter Rebbe's reading that it has to be sincere, internal, and towards everyone, then the original difficulty just slams right back into view. It's unresolved.
How can an observant person dedicating their life to divine service, upholding divine wisdom and commandments, how can they truly see themselves as lowlier than the lowliest sinner, someone on a totally different, maybe even opposing path?
That is the core paradox this chapter sets out to resolve. And it's not just a philosophical puzzle, right? It's a profound, almost jarring challenge to our ego, demanding we completely reevaluate what spiritual standing and inner transformation really mean. He's pushing us way beyond just being nice or outwardly humble.
Okay, so how does he resolve it? This feels like an impossible knot to untie. What's the key?
He offers a crucial instruction from the ancient sages, a timeless piece of wisdom that he argues is the very mechanism, the tool for achieving this genuine lowliness. The sages taught, judge not your fellow man until you have stood, that is, placed yourself in his place.
Judge not until you have stood in his place. We've heard that, but maybe not applied quite like this.
Right. He presents it not just as a moral guideline for empathy, but as the actual tool for radical self-assessment. It forces a complete imaginative, introspective shift in perspective.
So what does his place mean here? Is it just circumstances?
It's deeper. It's multi-layered. It's not just physical location. It refers to both the physical and the spiritual environment that shapes a person's actions, choices, struggles. It asks us to really consider the pressures, the challenges someone else faces that maybe we don't.
Let's break that down. Physical environment first.
Okay, think about that lowliest sinner. Their livelihood might force them into the marketplace all day. A chaotic place, constant exposure to temptation sights, sounds pulling the heart towards materialism, maybe dishonest gain, worldly distractions.
They're often bombardment.
Or maybe their situation leads them to idle on street corners.
If.
Less structure, more negative influences, fewer positive spiritual inputs. And the text makes this really insightful point about human nature. What the eyes see, the heart desires.
True.
So this constant, unavoidable exposure makes their daily struggle inherently harder. More relentless than someone who's, say, more insulated in a quieter, maybe more spiritually supportive environment, or whose life just doesn't involve that level of temptation.
Maybe we're in a kind of protected environment, a spiritual bubble.
And that protection undeniably makes our observance, our ability to resist temptation, significantly easier. It just does.
That immediately makes you reflect on your own situation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It forces you to ask, if I'm lucky enough not to face those temptations daily, if my life is structured differently, well, maybe my wins, my observance comes with a lot less effort than the intense battles someone else is fighting just to get through the day.
It puts your own perceived merit in a very different light, a much humbler light. It's not just what you do, but where you're doing it from.
Okay, so that's the physical place. What about the spiritual place?
Right. Beyond the physical, the text talks about their spiritual place. This refers more to the nature of their evil impulse, the intensity of their internal struggles. We aren't all wired the same way inside.
Some people seem naturally calmer, others more fiery.
Exactly. The text uses this powerful image, comparing someone's impulse to a baker's fiery oven, heated more frequently, more intensely than, say, a home oven used now and then. Some people are just born with a more passionate, maybe volatile nature, a stronger internal fire of desires, inclinations, even anger.
So for them, resisting isn't a gentle nudge.
No, it's a raging inferno they have to battle constantly with everything they've got. If your nature is calmer, more intellectual, less volatile, well, your internal oven might not burn as hot. Your struggles might be comparatively less fierce. Acknowledging these different inner temperaments is crucial for honest self-assessment.
But the text isn't letting the sinner off the hook, right? Mm-hmm. It's not saying, oh, well, it's too hard for them.
Absolutely not. This is critical. It is not absolving them of responsibility. Despite all these challenges, environmental, natural temperament, the text is clear. They have no ultimate excuse. They're still termed an utter evildoer because, fundamentally, they lack that genuine fear of the divine.
Because the mind can rule the heart.
The teaching insists on that. The human mind, by its very nature, has supremacy over the heart. It's an inborn divine gift that the mind is able to master and restrain desires no matter how intense, no matter how fiery the impulse. But, and this is the vital concession for our self-assessment, the text acknowledges it truly is a great, fierce struggle to break that fiery nature for the sake of fearing the divine. It calls it like a veritable test.
A real test.
Yes. Acknowledging the sheer intensity of that battle, the test-like quality of what the lowliest sinner faces just to restrain themselves, that's the crucial piece for the diligent person judging themselves. It sets the standard, an uncompromising yardstick for measuring your own efforts, not against some abstract ideal, but against the raw internal battle someone else is fighting.
Okay, so that sets the stage for self-examination. The text tells the introspective person, look at your own life, your own service.
According to your own unique place, your rank in divine service, weigh yourself, examine yourself, radically, honestly.
And the core question is, are you the diligent one, the observant one? Are you serving the divine in a way that demands a comparable struggle, a fierce battle, a test as intense as what that lowliest sinner faces just to not sin?
It forces you beyond just checking boxes, beyond outward conformity. It's about the effort, the internal war.
Let's look at the doing good category first. Mm-hmm. Prayer with devotion seems like a key example.
A central one. The text describes it as a daily battle, a war, really, waged against your own body, your own animal soul, both before and during prayer.
How so?
Before prayer, it means crushing those inner obstacles, those resistances, distractions like dust every single day before morning and evening prayers. Fighting inertia, the urge to rush, to just go through the motions, fighting the pull of comfort, of mundane thought.
And during prayer?
The expectation is to pour out your soul before the divine with entire strength, to the point of wringing out your intellectual and emotional power in devotion, exerting both spirit and body to remove hindrances, to truly connect, to feel awe, feel love. It's not casual. It's a full-on expenditure of inner resources, a spiritual workout.
That's a very high bar.
It is. And then the text delivers this challenge directly to the diligent person. If you haven't reached this standard of waging such a strenuous, intense war against your body and soul, if your prayer lacks this deep level of struggle and effort, then the text argues you haven't measured up.
Measured up to what?
Measured up to the intensity of the lowliest sinner's daily battle against their burning impulse to sin. Your struggle, even in doing something positive like prayer, isn't comparable to the fire they face just to avoid transgression. You might be doing the act, but is your inner battle as fierce?
Wow. So it's not just showing up. It's the quality of the fight inside. That really reframes doing well, doesn't it? Many of us think, I pray, I fulfill my duties, I'm good. But the question becomes, at what inner cost?
Yeah.
How hard are you really fighting for it?
Exactly. And the same demanding standard applies elsewhere, like having genuine intention during blessings, grace after meals, blessings before eating, before performing commandments. Each needs a similar internal fight against the impulse towards rote recitation, towards just getting it done, ensuring proper focus, real intention.
Not just mouthing words.
Right. And even more so, the intention behind performing any commandment at all, is it really being done purely for the divine's sake? Lishma. Or are there ulterior motives, self-serving reasons, seeking recognition, social approval, maybe just habit? The text strongly suggests that if you're honest, you'll find your intentions are often mixed, not as pure as they should be. Subtle impurities creep in.
That's uncomfortable to admit.
It is. Now consider Torah study another key area of doing good. The expectation isn't just studying regularly. It's struggling to study far more than your natural desire or habit dictates.
Pushing beyond your comfort zone.
Precisely. If you only study as much as you feel like or as much as you're used to, the text calls that a minor tussle. an easy battle, maybe even enjoyable. It requires little real effort or struggle against your inclination. It simply cannot be compared to the intense, fiery battle the lowliest sinner faces against impulses that could lead to serious transgression.
And then comes the really provocative statement.
Yes. The text says that if one doesn't struggle with their impulse to study much more than their nature demands, if they don't push beyond that comfort zone, they are no less wicked than the lowliest sinner.
Whoa! No less wicked. That's incredibly strong language.
It is. It completely challenges that ingrained idea that simply being observant, doing the right things, automatically makes you better. It forces the diligent person to look at the intensity of their own internal struggles, not just the outward actions. It's a call to profound self-honesty, showing that even in virtuous acts, you might be falling short in inner effort compared to someone you perceive as less observant.
Okay, so that covers doing good. What about turning away from evil for the observant person? Surely they have an advantage here compared to the lowliest sinner.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But this is where the text gets even more piercingly introspective and, frankly, uncomfortable for anyone who considers themselves basically righteous.
How sorry.
It points out that any thinking person, if they're truly honest and apply this rigorous internal lens, will discover they don't completely turn away from evil in every single way, especially not in situations requiring a significant battle comparable to the sinner's struggle, or even in situations requiring a lesser battle that they still fail to wage.
So it's about those subtle compromises, the small things we let slide.
Exactly. The unconscious permissions we grant ourselves. The text gives examples. Like the profound difficulty of stopping yourself mid-flow in a pleasant gossip session.
Oh, that's relatable.
Right. You're enjoying the chat, sharing some tidbit about someone, or maybe you're telling a story that even subtly discredits someone else, diminishes them somehow. And the text is incredibly precise. This applies even if the slur is slight. Even if it's factually true.
Even if it's true.
Even if it's true. And even if your main goal is just to clear your own name, to make yourself look good by comparison.
So it's not just outright lies or malice. It's those everyday conversations where we might carelessly diminish someone, maybe just out of habit, or because it feels good to share info, even if it's technically true but negative.
Precisely. It highlights the insidious nature of subtle negative speech. And the text includes this powerful anecdote.
About the sage and his son.
Yes. A revered sage rebukes his son for what seems like a minor self-indication. The son said something like, "I didn't write this document, Yehuda the tailor wrote it." Seems factual, harmless, right? Just clarifying who did what.
Yeah, sounds perfectly fine.
But the father's response, immediate and sharp, "Keep away from slander." It shows the incredibly high standard the text sets for turning away from evil. Even in things most people would dismiss as totally harmless. It demonstrates that the internal battle against this kind of subtle evil is rarely fought by the diligent person with the same intensity needed for bigger things.
And there are many similar situations.
So many occur frequently in daily life, where you just don't resist your impulse as you should, even in turning away from evil. Moments of impatience, subtle jealousy, holding a grudge, not speaking up when someone else is being put down. We often let our guard down.
Especially, the text says, regarding that commandment to sanctify yourselves.
Huh. Yes. Refraining from excessive indulgence, even in permitted matters. This isn't about avoiding forbidden things, but about restraint in what's allowed. Elevating yourself, not being enslaved by every desire, even permissible ones. Food, drink, comfort, entertainment.
So not being driven by every craving, even if it's allowed.
Exactly. And even if some traditions see it as a rabbinic rule, not directly biblical, the text reminds us rabbinic rules are often seen as even stricter.
Why stricter?
Because obeying them shows even greater devotion. It's obeying purely for the sake of heaven, out of love and commitment, not just direct divine command. Yet, how often do we succumb to self-indulgence when temptation is strong, when it requires a real battle to overcome?
We rationalize. It's allowed, so it's fine.
And in doing so, we miss a chance for self-mastery, for greater sanctity, for a deeper connection. We fail that inner battle.
This really hits home. How often we rationalize small things or just get desensitized. Things feel normal because everyone does it or it's not a big deal. A kind of spiritual numbness.
Precisely. The text calls these the sins which people trample underfoot. We become insensitive, regard them as trivial. They seem permissible just because they're done repeatedly. But they're subtle, potent, spiritual blocks.
So all these calculations, prayer depth, steady effort, speech care, self-restraint, if you're honest.
If you're truly honest, the observant person can reach this profound, unsettling conclusion. They are, in fact, no better than the lowliest sinner.
Because they also fail.
Because they, too, fail to wage the necessary war against their impulse when required. Maybe in different areas, maybe with different expressions. But the failure to engage in the required level of struggle is parallel. This is that crucial, maybe painful, but ultimately liberating step towards real humility. It just dismantles self-righteousness.
Okay, so we've seen how the diligent person might recognize their own failures as comparable, at least in terms of the internal struggle required.
Mm.
But then the text takes it even further, and this feels huge. It says the diligent person's guilt can actually be greater.
Yes. This is truly profound and perhaps the most challenging insight of the whole chapter. It asserts that for the observant individual, the scholar, the one who knows more, their guilt can indeed be greater than that of the lowliest sinner.
That feels so counterintuitive, even unfair. Why would knowing more, doing more good, lead to greater guilt?
It's the crux of the matter, isn't it? This is where the path to true humility becomes absolutely unavoidable. The text argues that if you are a scholar, if you uphold divine wisdom, if you genuinely want to be close to the divine, then your sin of not waging that war against your impulse, not overcoming it with the fierce intensity required, that sin is unbearably great. Your guilt is increased manifold.
Unbearably great.
It's a stark, uncompromising, deeply humbling statement. It completely redefines accountability based on potential and knowledge.
But why? Why is their guilt considered so much heavier than the person who's far removed, maybe doesn't even know what they're doing wrong in the same way?
It boils down to this profound principle. Increased responsibility comes with proximity and knowledge. The closer you are, the more you know, the heavier the weight. The text explains that the deeper your understanding of divine glory, the more you grasp the infinite nature of the divine, the closer you draw to the divine, to divine wisdom, to divine service, the more severe your lapses become.
A direct correlation.
Almost a terrifying one. The privilege of knowledge and closeness brings a heavier burden of accountability. The more you've been given, the more that's expected. Your failures have greater spiritual consequence.
And the text uses that example of the scholar who strayed, Acher.
Yes, Elisha ben Avruya, known as Acher, a brilliant scholar from the Talmudic era who ultimately abandoned his path. The divine is quoted as saying about him, "Because he knew my glory." The implication is stark. Despite his profound knowledge, despite his closeness to truth, he still sinned. And that knowledge, rather than excusing him, amplified the gravity exponentially.
Because he should have known better.
Precisely. His fall was more tragic, his guilt more profound, exactly because he had such a clear vision of what he was turning away from. For someone granted that insight, a lapse isn't just a mistake. It's a deeper betrayal of their understanding. A greater offense, in a sense, because they knew.
And this contrasts sharply with those who don't know as much.
Directly. The text cites the sages regarding illiterates, those far from deep learning. For them, deliberate sins are regarded in their case as inadvertent acts. Not excused, not inconsequential, but the gravity is lessened because they're genuinely unaware of the full depth of what they're doing wrong. Their knowledge is limited, their awareness perhaps undeveloped, culpability is reduced. They simply don't know better to the same degree.
But for the scholar, the diligent person.
The reverse is true. Even an oversight, maybe from not studying diligently enough, not being mindful enough, is judged as gravely as a deliberate sin. The expectation is higher. You should have known, should have studied, should have been more careful. This stark difference explains why the observant person's failure to fully restrain their impulse, to wage that internal war, is ultimately considered worse than the lowliest sinner's failure.
Because they have more tools, more insight, more resources, greater closeness.
And thus, their failure to fully use them carries a greater, almost unbearable weight of responsibility.
Wow. So this powerful realization that your own standing, your own knowledge, actually amplifies your accountability. That's the ultimate path. That's how you genuinely fulfill, be lowly of spirit before every man.
According to the text, yes. It's not about finding fault in others to feel better about yourself. It's about finding a deeper, more honest fault in yourself. Recognizing that your own struggles, measured against your potential and knowledge, might be far more significant than you thought.
It just crushes any lingering self-righteousness, any pride that whispers, "I'm better than that person." It forces you to confront your own battles with profound, unavoidable humility.
And by contemplating these truths, really assessing your own inner battles, successes, failures, against the backdrop of others' struggles, and understanding how knowledge increases accountability, the observant individual can truly fulfill that instruction. Be lowly of spirit before every man.
It's not about self-pity or just feeling bad.
Not at all. It's about arriving at a profound, honest self-assessment that genuinely crushes your own spirit's arrogance, that negative inclination of the animal soul. It dismantles the ego from its foundation.
Making room for something greater.
Exactly. And when that inner arrogance, that ego, is truly crushed and removed, it leads to a powerful spiritual transformation. It allows the light of your soul, often hidden by ego, self-importance, insensitivity, to really permeate and light up the body.
Connecting back to what we discussed last time, overcoming that spiritual dullness.
It's a continuous process. Challenging, yes, but ultimately liberating. A journey inward to unlock real spiritual vibrancy and connection.
So for you, our listener, here's maybe a provocative thought to mull over as you go about your day, maybe as you interact with people.
Mm-hmm.
In what specific area of your own life, maybe where you consider yourself pretty diligent or knowledgeable or spiritually on track, might you actually be facing what the text calls a minor tussle rather than a fierce struggle?
That's a deep question.
And what does that realization mean for your own path, your own inner growth, your journey towards genuine humility? Where can you push yourself further, not for show, but for a deeper, more authentic internal transformation?
Something to really think about.
We invite you to continue that deep dive on your own.